Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer, and as you've probably heard by now, Lou Reed died yesterday at 71. His passing was front page news in today's New York Times because Lou Reed was much more than a musician. As a singer and songwriter, he was a game changer. And for many listeners around the world, he was the personification of New York City. Rough-edged, hard-eyed, cool, probably dangerous. In the 60s, he co-founded the hugely influential band, The Velvet Underground.
Despite all the amputations, you know you could just go out and dance to the rock and roll station. It was all right.
It's all right.
Hey, baby, you know, it was all right.
It's all right.
After setting out on a solo career in 1970, Lou Reed produced albums that could be inspiring or infuriating or both. I mentioned in my blog post yesterday that as a Lou Reed fan, you had to constantly reconsider your fandom. You can read the whole post on our website, soundcheck.org. But with all the twists and turns in his career, his influence only seemed to grow stronger with each passing decade. For example, Kevin Barnes, who leads the band Of Montreal, has a Lou Reed moment or two that he's going to share with us later when Of Montreal comes in to perform live in our studio. But we want to hear as well from you about your Lou Reed moment, what he meant to you, a favorite song, a time you saw him in concert. And we'll start by welcoming back to Soundcheck our old friend Anthony DeCurtis, contributing editor to Rolling Stone. Hi, Anthony.
Hi, John. Good to be back.
What was, I mean, your his Lou Reed's relationship with journalists could be kind of fraught. How was it for you?
Well, I have to say, I mean, in all modesty, the last time I saw Lou, he said these very words to me. We were at a dinner. I teach at the University of Pennsylvania. I had him down there to do an interview with him in front of a group of invited guests. And it was quite a night. And then Lou agreed to have dinner with some faculty and students, which also was extraordinary. But at one point he just said to me, he goes, you know, people are always saying to me, you know, you don't get along with critics. You know, I was just in Europe and everybody's saying that to me. He goes, you know, I get along with Anthony DeCurtis. That shuts them right up. Now, why that would shut them right up, I have no idea. But he did say those words to me.
Nice. So, I mean, your reaction upon hearing the news yesterday that he had passed away, I mean, to try and encapsulate what he meant to the music world is a difficult thing to do.
Well, it's interesting. You know, I you know, this sounds kind of overstated, but I do believe that this is true, that other than Dylan and Lennon and McCartney, there is no more important figure in rock music than Lou Reed. I think that he essentially invented underground rock and alternative rock and the entire tradition, you know, with Iggy Pop and David Bowie right up till now with The National and Arcade Fire and Grizzly Bear, you know, and every stop in between. You know, Lou Reed put his stamp on that and on those artists and on those people. And that, you know, that Brian Eno line that everybody tosses around, 30,000 people bought the first Velvet Underground record, but all of those people formed a band, every single one of them. And that was true.
Mm-hmm. So the Velvet Underground, I mean, it wasn't just a band. It was part of a bigger kind of downtown New York circus.
Yes, part of the exploding plastic inevitable. I mean,
this is Andy Warhol.
Yes, exactly. This Andy Warhol kind of performance, to say piece would be to, but these performance events, I suppose, kind of performance art, you know, at which the Velvet Underground were kind of the centerpiece, you know, in which, you know, someone like Gerard Malango would get up there with leather pants and a whip, and there would be, you know, images brought, you know, film images on the walls, and there would be a light show, and there would be obviously a band playing, and all of that together, you know, connected these kind of elements of, you know, the New York underground and kind of distilled it into a sound, you know, so that when the first time you heard, you know, I'm waiting for the man or something. I mean, it sounded like the six train, like rumbling along the tracks, you know. It had that New York feel.
And it was a side of New York that people were not writing about.
Not writing about in rock and roll, certainly.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the points that Lou Reed always made, he goes, look, you know, if I were writing novels, if I were Nelson Algren or William Burroughs, if I were Martin Scorsese, you know, nobody would bat an eye at this stuff. He goes, but I'm trying to get it into rock and roll songs, and that's what gets under people's skin.
And the song you mentioned, I'm Waiting for the Man, I mean, you just listen to the lyrics. It's a drug buy going down.
$26 in my hand. Up to Lexington, 125. Sick and dirty, more dead than alive. I'm waiting for my man. Hey, white boy, what you doing uptown? Hey, white boy, you chasing all women around. Pardon me, sir, it's furthest from my mind. I'm just looking forward to a dear friend of mine. I'm waiting for my man.
I'm waiting for the man. An early kind of proto-indie rock or underground rock song.
Yeah, absolutely.
From Lou Reed and the Velvet Underground.
Both sonically and in terms of its you know, subject matter, as you mentioned, you know, a kind of drug buy up in Harlem. You know, again.
And it's so specific.
Oh,
Lexington
absolutely.
And 125.
Oh, and that is the great thing about it. I mean, it, you know, and why he's so much beloved by New Yorkers. You know, it's just like, well, you don't know where that is. That's okay. Figure it out. You know, it's just
We're speaking with Anthony DeCurtis, contributing editor of Rolling Stone, about the late Lou Reed. Now, you mentioned that, you know, his influence continues to be felt today. It was felt almost immediately through people like David Bowie, who in the early 70s started singing I'm Waiting for the Man in his concerts.
Right.
And then, of course.
Well, you know, I mean, right up the line, you know, a little bit later. I mean, Iggy Pop, of course.
Mm-hmm.
A little bit further on down the line, you know, Patti Smith and Talking Heads and Television. You know, after that, mm-hmm. post-punk, you get, you know, R.E.M. and U2.
And there's also the moment where Bowie and Reed come together in what was a kind of transformative moment.
Oh, well, that
in
album
Reed's
Transformer,
career.
Of course. I mean, included, you know, Lou's great hit, you know, Walk on the Wild Side, but also just a great kind of, it was like Lou's take on glam rock and his, you know, kind of Americanization of glam rock. And at the same time, you know, it was a record that made a tremendous impact and took for granted, you know, this kind of demimonde of, you know, sexual adventurism and drug use that, you know, now, I mean, again, is something that, you know, is kind of well-worn, but at the time was kind of really eye-opening.
Mm-hmm. And there are kind of flashes of humor on that record,
absolutely.
Too. A New York telephone conversation, for example. And also kind of elements of, there's like a romantic element to it too.
Deeply romantic. And I think this is the kind of element of Lou Reed that often gets overlooked.
Absolutely.
You know, there is a kind of a yearning for what you might call almost kind of traditional love and connection,
mm-hmm.
I think, that runs through his work. There's a tremendous empathy with these characters, although it's completely unsentimental with the you know, inhabitants of the demimonde. But on the other hand, Lou always had his eye, you know, that I want to play football for the coach and this idea on what another life might have been.
Well, you're quoting from the song Coney Island Baby.
Yes.
Where, you know, that line repeats, I just want to play football for the coach. And
right.
I know a lot of people were sort of taken aback by that because this is the guy who writes about, you know, S&M and heroin addiction. What's he writing about wanting to get a letter on your varsity, you know, on your jersey for, on your jacket?
Well, you know, I do really do believe, you know, there's a great moment at the beginning of that album, 1969, which was a, you know, a tape of the Velvet Underground playing down in Texas. And it opens with a long kind of monologue by Lou talking to them about watching the Dallas Cowboys on TV that day. And he says to the audience, you know, because I saw the Cowboys, you know, they're playing the 49ers today, and they just, you know, it was just not, it was a joke. They just, you know, ran away with the game and won it by, you know, however many touchdowns. And he goes, you know, you got to give people a little bit of a chance in football anyway. And, you know, that sense of, you know, Lou Reed, you know, I mean, I think people's notions about like Lou Reed in Dallas on a Sunday afternoon is going to be like wandering around like looking for the nearest drug dealer. But in fact, he was watching the Dallas Cowboys and pondering the meaning of their, you know, runaway upset victory.
So this, too, was part of Lou Reed, as we hear in the song Coney Island Baby.
You know, man, when I was a young man in high school, you believe it or not, I wanted to play football for the coach. And all those older guys, they said that he was mean and cruel, but you know, I want to play football for the coach. They said I was a little too lightweight to play linebacker, so that I'm playing right in. Want to play football for the coach. But you know someday, man, you gotta stand up straight unless you're gonna fall. Then you're going to die. And the straightest dude I ever knew was standing right by me all the time. So I had to play football for the coach. I want to play football for the coach.
That is Lou Reed with the title track from the album Coney Island Baby. We're remembering a complicated guy.
Without question.
On Soundcheck today. Anthony DeCurtis with me, contributing editor at Rolling Stone. Listeners, we want to hear about your Lou Reed memory, your Lou Reed moment, the impact his music had on you, seeing him in concert, maybe a run-in with the man himself. You can call us at 866-939-1612 or leave a comment on our website, soundcheck.org. The number again, toll free, 866-939-1612. Tim from Sedona posted this. I saw Lou Reed at the Bottom Line in the Village. I guess it was mid-80s. This was a scene I was not going to forget, and of course, the place was packed, which it always would be when Lou Reed performed, but, you know, there were definite peaks and valleys.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. I mean, look, and this is something also another thing I think that, you know, people don't get when you're living, you know, you don't get to really alter the course of music more than once or twice in your career. And, you know, and if you do it once, that immediately puts you in the pantheon of people. If you're living contemporaneously with an artist, you know, there's going to be some down moments. And especially someone like Lou Reed, who is not really censoring himself. I mean, every time out, you know, he was trying to do whatever it was he felt at that moment. Sometimes it worked, sometimes it didn't. But, you know, it certainly worked enough time. I mean, even during that long solo career, man, there are 6 or 8 records, it seems to me, that, you know, are extremely significant.
Mm-hmm. Was he, in your experience, much of a tech geek? I mean, he seemed
completely.
To...
I mean, that was the
thing. That seems to be another surprising answer.
Well, yeah, well, I know, because he's revered for the kind of quote-unquote rawness of those early records, which he would complain about endlessly. I mean, he felt like, you know, because of what the band was doing, you know, the engineers wouldn't really give him proper attention. And the band, you know, they were novices and they didn't know how to do it themselves. So, you know, he heard those records in a very different way from everybody else who loved them. And he used to say to me all the time, I mean, I'm, you know, helpless technically. And, you know, I was using, you know, cassette tapes until, you know, not that long ago. And Lou would sit, every time I sat down to interview him, he goes, you know, because you're never going to give that up. Here, you know, like call this guy, you know, he'll get you this machine. And, you know, we went through the whole thing. He'll get you a DAT machine. He'll get you a digital recorder, you know, whatever it was.
Do you remember his book of photography?
Of course.
From 2006?
Absolutely.
So Lou came on Soundcheck and he was shooting with a digital camera back then. And I noted during the course of our interview that, you know, he had lived through that transition from the analog to the digital age in both music and photography.
big advantage for me.
Mm-hmm.
I had a major league advantage because this already went down in music. You see what's happened. We're at the beginning of the... This is like the invention of the airplane or something. It's that big a thing. We're at the very beginning of the biggest change ever. It's mm-hmm. really fantastic. And mourning the loss of film or tape is not the point of all this. They're two different things. However, the digital makes it possible for everybody, anywhere, to go right out and make some music
mm-hmm.
or take a picture.
And that's another part of his legacy, isn't it? That DIY is that idea that yeah. anyone can do it.
Sure, because if you hear, I mean, you know, as you know, every single person playing on that, you know, I'm Waiting for the Man, you know, is like an amazing musician, you know. I mean, obviously John Cale and Sterling Morrison, certainly, and even in her own way, Maureen Tucker. At the same time, you know, it sounds so raw, and it does sound like the kind of thing like, God, if I just got together with my friends, we could play that, you know,
right.
And that was huge. I mean, that was really, really important.
Now, are there underappreciated albums in his career that you think people should be revisiting?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. You know, there's New Sensations, for example, from the 80s is a record that, you know, doesn't really get the attention that I think it deserves. And from the very end, I mean, I think it might be the last studio album he made called Ecstasy,
mm-hmm.
I think is a really, really powerful record. And I have no doubt that if he'd continue to record, he could still come up with a great record. You know, he had that kind of vision.
So Ecstasy was his sort of last major studio album. I mean, the Raven had lots of other people.
Yes.
Lulu had Metallica. This was a Lou Reed album.
Right. And it, you know, it was raw, and there was a kind of emotional desperation in it that about relationships in particular that really made me wonder, like, what was going on with him and Laurie Anderson, or if it was really autobiographical. I mean, it wasn't. It evidently was not. But, you know, he had that ability to just kind of really cut right into the bone. And when you listen, you know, to that music on that record, you know, you can feel that. Although the title track, Ecstasy, is actually very beautiful in its own way.
Well, let's hear a little bit of that. The title track from Lou Reed's 2000 record, Ecstasy.
Across the streets, an old Ford that took off its wheels. The engine is gone. In its seat sits a box with a note that says, "Goodbye, Charlie, thanks a lot." I see a child through a window with a bib, and I think of us and what we almost did. The Hudson rocketing with light, the ships past the Statue of Liberty at night. They call it ecstasy, 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 ecstasy. Some men call me Saint Ivory, some call me Saint Maurice. I'm smooth as alabaster, with white veins running through my cheeks. A big stud through my eyebrow.
That is Lou Reed with the title track from his 2000 album called Ecstasy, an underappreciated record, according to Anthony DeCurtis, my guest, contributing editor of Rolling Stone. I always had a soft spot in my heart for the Bells.
Oh, you know what? I did notice that in your blog, and I agree completely. That's a record that's often disparaged, and I never quite understood why. I mean, it's really daring, but on the other hand, inside all of these experiments is an incredible musicality,
yeah.
I think you would agree, and certainly on that record.
You know, listeners, we're talking about Lou Reed, who died yesterday at the age of 71. There are as many views of Lou Reed as there are listeners, I suppose. And we want to hear your Lou Reed moment, the impact he had on you, seeing him either in person or on stage. You can call us at 866-939-1612. Or leave a comment at soundcheck.org. The number again, 866-939-1612. And Matthew is joining us on the line here in New York, in fact, from Tribeca. So, Matthew, you're not just from the same city as Lou Reed, but the same general area as well, right?
Absolutely.
So did you ever see him on the street?
I used to see him on the street on several occasions. In fact, as you know, Tribeca is sort of littered with celebrities from the music and film world.
Right.
And so I sort of have my pick of celebrities that I would, you know, semi-stalk down the block. Lou was high among them.
Uh-huh.
And there's only a couple of others that sort of rate my personal stalking behavior.
I'll take the semi part of the stalking behavior seriously there, Matthew. So do you have a Lou Reed memory or moment for us?
Yeah, I do. And it's not from recent times. It's actually from when the Velvet Underground first happened and that whole Andy Warhol scene was percolating and then exploding here in New York. That particular era and epoch was of my older sister's generation.
Mm-hmm.
And so she had the great fortune to, you know, probably pass through the factory at one point or another. And I unfortunately was too young to experience that specific scene and the clubs of the day, like the Cheetah and the Dave Paul scene and the Electric Circus. I hit the next generation, so New Wave and CBGBs and Mud Club and mm-hmm. Area a little later on. And
by which point, Lou Reed was sort of, an Eminence Grease.
Yes,
kind
exactly.
Of.
Absolutely. And didn't he take the 80s off?
No.
New York came out in the 80s.
Yeah,
I mean, that
yeah,
was
yeah.
A great record.
There were a couple of things in the 80s, he was definitely sort of changing.
I think
changing.
The Bells came out in the 80s, too.
Or it was right around the 79, 80, time. Matthew, thanks very much for the call. Again, we're remembering Lou Reed, who passed away yesterday at the age of 71. We've got Anthony DeCurtis with us here in the studio, contributing editor to Rolling Stone, and your calls and comments at 866-939-1612. We'll continue in just a moment, and live music from the Band of Montreal coming up later on Soundcheck. Tonight, make sure to visit our website, soundcheck.org, at 10 p.m. Eastern to listen to Arcade Fire live in concert. The band will be playing songs from their new album, Reflector, from Capitol Studios in Los Angeles. That's Arcade Fire tonight, 10 p.m. Eastern, live on soundcheck.org from L.A. Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Lou Reed's Perfect Day is from that Watershed album called Transformer that David Bowie and his guitarist Mick Ronson produced for Lou Reed back in the early 70s. Anthony DeCurtis, contributing editor of Rolling Stone, here with me as we're remembering Lou Reed, who passed away yesterday at the age of 71. It's funny how this song, Perfect Day, now has like a second or even third life in pop culture.
No, and it's, obviously with his death, it's something that's been referred to a million times. And, of course, you know, Transformer and the album that, Transformer was a big hit. On the other hand, you know, the album that came after it, Berlin, you know, was just vilified at mm-hmm. the time. And, of mm-hmm. course, you know, that's a kind of accrued significance, over time. And, you know, I was just listening to that part from Perfect Day, you know, with its allusion to the Supremes. I mean, Lou, of course, loved Motown with that "You Keep Me Hanging On" idea, you know, and worked into a song that's, you know, really a kind of cry of desperation. You know, it's amazing stuff.
And, a song that I think probably took aback people who were used to songs like Vicious or, yes. Rock and Roll or Heroin, where it's, I remember thinking, this sounds like something my parents would listen to. Why do I like this? And yet I did.
Right.
I couldn't quite figure that out.
I think that's another part of that kind of yearning in his music, that there was a great kind of... romantic yearning.
Mm.
And the same way that there always was a musicality, I think within the darkest and even most cynical and grating and scarifying stuff, there still was that element of emotionality and romance.
Yeah. Let's take a call. Carlos is on the line with us from Long Island City. Hi, Carlos.
Hey, how are you?
Okay. You got a Lou Reed memory for us?
Not so much a memory, but just an encapsulation of time in New York. I moved into the East Village in 88, in my early 20s, and when New York came out the following year in 89, that whole album just seemed to perfectly preserve and amber what New York City was going through with the crack epidemic and the AIDS epidemic.
Exactly.
And stepping over homeless people every day on my way to work in Soho. And each one of those songs was just another part of my daily life. And Lou was able to put in his lyrics, the disgust and the love and the excitement of being in New York City at that time. And I spent a good part of the day re-listening to that album, and it just kind of really makes you remember.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was, I think that's an amazing record, and precisely for the reason that Carlos identified. At that point, there were 2,000 murders a year in this city. I remember, somebody getting killed in a Gap store in the middle of the afternoon on a weekday, and I just thought, man, if you can't secure, West 57th Street on a Wednesday afternoon, this city is just out of control, know?
And yet, at that point, Lou Reed had sort of gotten his life under control.
That's true. And I think, that New Sensations album that came out, I think, in 84, I think marked that point, the title track talks about a desire to really, he goes, a year ago today, I was arrested on Christmas Eve. And, there was a sense in that song, that's never going to happen again. That's not going to be my life. I'm not going out like that. And at the same time, there was a kind of aesthetic statement on the record, doing the things that we want to, where he talks about Sam Shepard, and he talks about Martin Scorsese, and he talks about, this is the work we want to do. This is the stuff that we care about. And it's so powerful and affecting.
This is the song, Doing the Things That We Want To, from that album, The New Sensations by Lou Reed.
There's not much you hear on the radio today, hey.
Doing the things that you want to.
But you could still see a movie or a play.
Doing the things that you want to.
Here's to Travis Bickle and here's to Johnny Boy. Song, 'cause I'd like to shake your hand. In a way, you guys, the best friends I ever had.
Doing the things that we want to.
Doing the things that we want to. That we want to. A true love.
Lou Reed, Doing the Things That We Want To, from his 1984 album, New Sensations. Connie from Jackson Heights writes that she saw him a couple of times in concert. She writes, very sad, very brave, uncompromising, launched 1,000 groups, all of which not even open to debate. That's
exactly.
All absolutely true.
Perfectly
he was
true.
Uncompromising. He could be very prickly. Anthony, did you ever get on his bad side?
When I invited him down to Penn, this is the only time he was going to come down and do this thing. It's an evening that we have at the Kelly Writers House at Penn. And the day before he was supposed to come, it involves going to a reception and then, doing an interview with me for an hour and then having dinner with faculty and students, But he agreed to it, you know? Mm-hmm. And then at the last minute, it was just, well, I don't really want to do the reception, and I don't really want to do the dinner. And I just like, Lou, look, you know, it's like the 11th hour here. You can't do this. And he just said, well, we could just blow off the whole thing together, right? We could just blow it off. And it was like, man, I was at the last moment. But of course he came down, and it was an amazing experience for everybody who was there. He totally showed up. And his one demand, I mean, this is the thing, like, what is Lou Reed going to ask for? He asked for kielbasa. I am not joking. Which we got him from DeBruno's down in Philadelphia, and he was literally ecstatic.
He was full of surprises. Back in 2006, he was on soundcheck to talk about his photography book called Lou Reed's New York. And this was, you remember our old studios, our old WNYC studios. They were located in a city-operated building with tight security. Listen to me desperately trying to wrap up our interview that day.
It's called Lou Reed's New York, which
but
is
But if it had to go through the security you guys have downstairs, I'm amazed it even got upstairs.
We are important people here.
Yeah. They're so sweet downstairs. You know, I came in with a little dog, and they said, do you have the papers for this dog? I said, she's a very important dog, but I actually didn't bring her passport and papers with her.
Oh,
I said, okay, guy, out. That's it.
So the dog is waiting for you elsewhere, then?
The dog is elsewhere being photographed to get a dog passport to get into your building.
Sensational.
He was not happy that he couldn't get his little dog.
So great that he could not let it go, either. Yeah, that was not a great trait, letting it go.
No. And thank goodness for that, because he never let go of so many things that made him so important to so many people. Anthony DeCurtis, contributing editor to Rolling Stone, remembering Lou Reed, who died yesterday at the age of 71. Anthony, great to see you again.
Oh, well, thank you so much.
You hit me.